comforted. You know, I felt like, you know, I had this personal relationship with Jesus and whatnot. And so my parents' marriage was kind of on the rocks. So even when things were not happy at home, I had this sense that I was cared for, that I was part of something greater than myself. Well, I grew up and went through high school, went into the service as a non-combatant. I became a Navy hospital corpsman. I wound up serving 2 years with the Marine Corps, actually, a year in San Diego and a year in Vietnam, 3rd Marine Division Ground Forces, and then came back home again. And I went back to my church a couple of times, but I'd become actually quite disillusioned. Because mainstream Christianity, basically, up until the end of the 70s, didn't really have much to say about the war one way or another, except for the Society of Friends. If you were a member of the Society of Friends, you could get conscientious objector status from your draft board and get alternative service. Other than that, it was entirely dependent on whoever your pastor was in the denomination of the church that you were in. There was a fellow that I knew in my church who very sincerely opposed killing any other human being for any reason. And he had sought conscious objector status, which required that our minister testify on his behalf before the draft board. And our minister refused to do so because he thought that, you know, it was your Christian duty to serve your country. And that was it. I'd had it, you know. Just based on what I'd just come home from, I realized that this was no longer my path, you know, and so I tried tantric yoga and Taoism for a while, and then sat with a couple of Tibetan masters, and then finally discovered this practice, you know, Theravada Buddhist practice. And then came to what I brought to my early Buddhist studies, my early Buddhist practice, just like we all do, we bring to the experience whatever our prior experience had been. And so what I brought to my first encounters with Buddha Dharma was this understanding that, well, you know, it's a religion, kind of like Christianity, only not, you know. But really, the more I studied and the more I practiced, the more I came to realize that that was really not at all a complete understanding. When later on I went to write books about this sort of thing, came across this definition, or the etymology of the word religion, okay, from the Latin, has two different sort of meanings. One means to bind together, like if you take a lot of individual reeds and bind them together to make something stronger, right? The other is to say over and over, as in a liturgy. So those two aspects, the definition of religion, basically people bound together, you know, in some kind of organization or institution for the sort of the recitation of belief. And that's not really, that didn't really quite comport with what my understanding was of what was going on as I explored Buddha Dharma and whatnot. And then when I later on wrote about spirituality and the management of public lands, mostly from the perspective or the point of view or the legal position of American Indian tribes and other indigenous people of the Americas, I had to find a definition that of what I was talking about, spirituality. So I was eventually able to come up with a definition that was seemed to be applicable to all the indigenous earthen traditions, as well as the ones that we would speak of as the world's great religions. Not to speak so much about religion per se, but rather about the nature of spiritual experience. Like Carl Jung once said that religious institutions are a defense against religious experience. The poet John Chiardi once wrote, if you can afford to call God, if religion answers, hang up. So we have this interestingly American distinction that we made between religion and spirituality. The nature of spiritual experience, as I came to define it, has three aspects. One is that it's extra-rational, goes beyond the bounds of discursive thought. Okay, it's a kind of an expanded way of experiencing the world. Secondly, that it's transcendent in nature, that there is this sense of moving beyond the boundaries of self, out into the universe. And the third aspect is that it's unitive. Not only do you move beyond the boundaries of self, but you have a sense of being part of something that's greater than yourself. In the Mahayana tradition, they call it Buddha mind. You sort of entered the mind of the universal Buddha. Well, I found these ideas fascinating, but also a little bit disturbing, because some of the things that I'd really appreciated about Christianity, you know, the sense of community, and at this time, there wasn't any Insight Meditation Society, and there wasn't any Spirit Rock Meditation Center, and the teachers that was hanging with, whose retreats I were going to, Joseph Goldstein, Jack Kornfield, and Sharon Salzberg, they were kind of itinerant, mendicant lay monks, you know. They would just wander around the country and sleep on friends' couches and stuff and wherever, and we'd put together a retreat someplace, and they'd go teach the retreat and whatnot. So it was, felt kind of like a ongoing Grateful Dead concert or something. It was only much later that we kind of put together these sort of institutions. But I realized that there was a real distinction that was happening in my own experience between my previous experience, certainly in a mainstream religion, and what I was undergoing now, which is really in some ways kind of different. And then if you just, and we certainly have Buddhist institutions of all kinds and all traditions all over the world, including here in the United States. But just as Jesus wasn't a Christian, the Buddha wasn't a Buddhist. Buddhism is a word of Western derivation. It was created by academics to allow for the comparative study of Buddha Dharma and other religions, because they chose to classify it as a religion. So you'll hear, you know, when you hear me speak, you'll notice that I don't often talk about Buddhism because that's an academic subject. I do talk a lot about Buddha Dharma, the teachings of the Buddha, instead. And there's really a kind of a distinction between the two. What the Buddha taught in terms of some of these essential distinctions about the nature of mind and the nature of spiritual experience was in some ways profoundly radical, not only for his time, but for our time as well. Because at the time of the Buddha, the religious, the state religion basically, the religious tradition extant at the time, was a Brahmanism or Hinduism. And Brahmanism or Hinduism posited much the same thing that most other theistic religions do. Okay. What they teach, is that there is a universal supreme being, a Brahman, omniscient, omnipotent, okay, ruler of the universe, basically. That there is Atman, or the soul, okay, the eternal soul that transmigrates through multiple reincarnations in an ongoing path toward purification and eventual unity between Brahman and Atman, one's own eternal soul and the great being. Again, not that different from a lot of the mainstream theistic religions today. So, what the Buddha is sometimes regarded as now, given the way he taught, was rather than being the founder of a religion, he was basically an empirical philosopher. Okay. Because what he posited was a completely different understanding of the nature of mind. What he taught was based upon his own experience. You know, he was well schooled in Brahmanism as he was being raised. He kind of understood that system and what it was all about. But when he decided to go forth, rather, and he wasn't born into the Brahmin caste, into the priestly caste anyway, he went out to follow the path of the recluse, to essentially go into the wilderness and simply examine his own bare experience. And as he went into the wilderness, he sought out various teachers that had different techniques to offer and whatnot. His principal goal from the time he went forth and to the time that he achieved enlightenment, and then as he taught for the rest of his life, had to do with the nature of dissatisfaction in the human spirit. Why do we suffer? Where does it come from? Why does it arise? How might it be brought to an end? So when he felt he had achieved the answers to these questions, okay, he formulated them into a set of teachings that he went forth to offer. When he went forth to offer, he prefaced his teachings on the subject matter with teachings about his teachings and how he wanted them to be heard or understood. And one of the things he said was, I'm not here to tell you that I'm replacing what's out there now, you know, Brahma and Anatman and the unity of the tool, the permanent and abiding self, you know. What I am doing is to present to you the facts of my own experience, just conveying to you the nature of my experience and how my observations led me to the point of ultimate freedom from dissatisfaction, freedom from dukkha, freedom from suffering. Should this be your goal as well, you may want to try the same things that I try. Try these ideas on for size and see if they fit. Okay. One of the phrases, abide contemplating the possibility that this is so. Unlike many other teachers at the time, he didn't come in and say, everything you've been taught is wrong. You should believe this instead. What he said was, this is what I discovered. If your goal is my goal, I invite you to do the things that I did by way of meditation practices, to reflect upon what I am teaching you, and then to see if it rings true for you. For me, starting out, you know, with, you know, serious inquiry into Buddha, Dharma, and then doing the practices and whatnot, that was in and of itself a profoundly inviting teaching, because I wasn't being told to dump one ideology and grab onto another one. I was invited to come and inquire and see if the way the Buddha perceived the world kind of comported with my own, if it was a closer approximation of what was my own experience. And so I did. And I really, sooner or later, had to come up against or to deal with this core teaching of the Buddha. Because what he taught at the time said, in my experience, in my inquiry, I found no permanent and abiding self. And I found no universal, omniscient, omnipotent master of the universe. I did not deny the existence of non-corporeal beings existing on different planes of existence, including Brahma. You thought of it, you know, in the colloquial terms, as if, you know, are these realms of existence, one could have it. In Theravadan psychology, basically those realms of existence are states of mind, you know, in terms of how your mind is processing things. I said, of the various kinds of suffering we experience, there's some that are associated simply with being in a body, catching head colds, getting nasty diseases, getting injured, getting old, dying, you know. stuff happens, right? And so there is the suffering on the physical plane that goes, that occurs there. There is the suffering that goes along with us not wanting those things to be as they are. And he said, that form of dissatisfaction is in fact something that we can do something about. Okay. And the way he laid it out, and again, there's this tendency to glom onto this as if it was religious doctrine. He said, I invite you to think on this possibility, you know, as a kind of a philosophical framework or suggestion, right? That dissatisfaction with things as they are is real, that it exists. It's something that we experience. Okay. The first ennobling truth, okay, the truth of the existence of dukkha, of unsatisfactoriness in life. It's interesting with these four noble truths, he doesn't use the same verb with each one of them. He uses a different verb with each one. He said this first ennobling truth is to be understood. To understand that there is suffering in the world, including the suffering created by the actions of our own mind. The second ennobling truth, he said, is to be is that the source, the origins of this self-created suffering, literally, is craving and clinging. Essentially wanting things to be different than they are. So he said there is this thirst, there is this desire for things to be a certain way, for there to be certain kinds of experience. He said, as a result, we have a continuous craving for sense gratification. It's difficult to let go of because once the senses are gratified, the hunger returns and they need to be gratified again and again till the mind digs itself down into ruts associated with craving and clinging to sensual gratification. He said another form of craving and clinging is clinging to religious rites and rituals as if they themselves will bring about enlightenment. Okay. Rather than simply seeing rites and rituals as being skillful means, ways of reminding oneself of some core teachings. He said, clinging to views and opinions about how things are, whether it's politics or metaphysics, religion, that being so in love with your own ideas and so disparaging of others is a real source of suffering, not only interpersonally, but socially as well. And he said, the other source of craving and clinging that is exceedingly difficult to let go of is a craving for eternity. A craving for eternal life, for eternal existence that goes beyond this body, you know. And when I was a little kid in Christian church, you know, we were saying, you know, believe on me and thou shalt have life everlasting, you know. My grandma used to sing this song, this world is not my home, I'm just a passing through. My treasures are laid up somewhere beyond the blue. The angels beckon me from heaven's open door, and I can't feel at home in this world anymore. This notion that we inhabit this realm of dukkha, right? But there, you know, there is this place we're going to beyond where we'll live forever, you know, in heaven with God and Jesus. Woody Guthrie in the 1930s, he wrote a little song about this. It's called There'll Be Pie in the Sky When You Die. And he was kind of saying, you know what, you know, this is just a way to keep you from paying attention to the fact that your life's pretty awful, you know, and maybe you ought to do something about it. So, having been taught that, all of a sudden to hear this other teaching, was kind of got my attention. You know, he said this notion of eternal life right? That you'll transmigrate over and over again through your rebirths until you're one with Brahman. He said that's basically just another appetite of the mind. It's essentially an appetite of the ego, the desire for eternal existence. And he said that what these cravings do as they emanate from the discursive mind is that they begin to create like a spider's web or a cocoon or a self-constructed prison. The self, in its desire to continuously gratify these cravings, creates this world, whose only purpose is the satisfaction of those cravings. So he said, it is those cravings themselves and our continuous efforts to satisfy them that create the suffering that we experience. So he said, if you want to experience the cessation of suffering, you have to abandon the craving. So first, ennobling truth, the reality or the existence of dukkha, dissatisfaction, suffering, is to be understood. The second ennobling truth, which is the origins of suffering, dukkha, dissatisfaction, the cravings and clingings, are to be abandoned. When that abandonment happens, he says, and the third ennobling, enabling truth, one experiences the cessation of suffering because you experience the cessation of the created self that experiences the suffering. I'll say that again. The realization of the cessation of suffering happens when the mind ceases to create the self that experiences the suffering. Okay. And then the fourth enabling and ennobling truth, the cultivation, okay, that this realization, you can have it like Chan-ul, the founder of Korean Zen, talked about these, the third and fourth noble truth, as sudden illumination and gradual cultivation. That you can experience the cessation of suffering because you experience the cessation of self. But then that, like all other compounded phenomena, is impermanent. You get it, it goes away. And so then you cultivate it over a longer period of time. So the Buddha said that fourth noble truth is to be developed, which is the Eightfold Path. So what he said was here, that which we think of is as a permanent and abiding self is nothing more than a manifestation of the desire for eternal existence. And that once you are able to disrupt or allay or relax that craving for eternal existence, that belief in a permanent abiding self, then its hold on you is weakened and in some cases falls away completely. The Buddha said, in my experience, rather than there being a fixed, permanent, eternal, and abiding self, that which we think of as self is nothing more than a rapidly occurring sequence of mental processes. It's a continuous fabrication process that the mind engages in. When he first began to teach, there were representatives of these various schools of philosophy that were out there already. They're generally referred to in the discourses as the eternalists and the nihilists. You know, the eternalists were coming from pretty much the mainstream Brahman view, you know, just as I was talking, you know, the Atman, the eternal soul that transmigrates from body to body. Okay. And then there were the nihilists who say It's all meaningless. You know, you're born, you die, and that's it. And there is no purpose, meaning, direction. There is no reason to live a good life or a bad life or anything else, because regardless of how you live your life, you're just going to die, and that's it. Okay. And so they each come to him, and they say, this is our position. Do you agree with it? And he'd say, no. And then the other side would come, and they'd say, well, this is our position. Is it yours? No. They were basically trying to recruit him to their points of view, and he was having none of it. Then he'd quit. He just quit talking to him. And they get disgusted because they wanted to fight. You know, they wanted to duke it out, have a little dharma combat. He was having none of it, so they'd all just go away after a while. He'd say, he's useless, and he's not one of us. And then his followers were a little disappointed. They said, well, why didn't you straighten these people out? You know, he said, they couldn't have heard what I had to say. He said, the self cannot be said to exist, nor can the self be said to not exist. Because the self is a creation of self. Now you see it, now you don't. It's like Princess Leia's hologram, right? Whatever she was, you know. She was a real hologram until she wasn't. And in much the same way, the Buddha said, the mind conjures self, okay, brings self into being, okay, and then when it no longer needs it, it'll fall away, it'll dissolve. Self is constantly being conjured, put to use, and then abandoned, and reconjured, and put to use, and abandoned. It's kind of an ongoing process. Future talks. And it turns out I was mistaken about the calendar. I don't teach next week. We're back to our regular schedule. I teach the second and fourth Sundays of next month instead. Future talks, we're going to talk about the related teachings that flesh out or give meaning to anatta. Where does the word anatta come from? Well, we're talking about Brahman and Atman, right? The universal being, the eternal soul. So the Buddha, in saying, in my experience, there is no permanent abiding self. There is no Atman. There is Anatman, not self. That's where the term Anatta comes from. Literally translates as not self. Sometimes you'll hear it translated as no self or non-self, whatever, but the reason that I tend to use not self, as do some other teachers, is that, as in the Buddha's words, he doesn't say, it's not like the self doesn't exist. You create the self on a moment-to-moment basis. So it's there to the extent you create it. When the mind's not creating self, it doesn't exist. Okay. Well, one of the teachers in this tradition, Tanjef, has a nice little Dharma talk written up as a kind of an essay called the Not-Self Strategy, you know. And as did the Buddha, he says, instead of thinking about these as, you know, as core doctrines that you must believe in, the Buddha said, you shouldn't take anything, I say that way. You should understand these teachings from the utilitarian point of view. These teachings are presented to you in order to fulfill a purpose. These teachings are presented to you for the purpose of becoming free of suffering. And once you've been able to use these teachings for that purpose, set them aside. Okay. And that's exactly the way he taught about anatta, you know. This is, it's a concept, it's an idea, it's a means of thinking about or reflecting on the nature of self that I think you would benefit from contemplating. Furthermore, as you do your meditation practice, watch carefully the ways of the mind. See if you can discern when mind is creating self and when mind is not creating self. And when you can find those little places where the mind is not creating self, the Tibetan teacher, Soknyin Rinpoche, says, it's like beads on a mala, you know, you know, like a beaded bracelet you use for doing, you know, chanting. He said, as you loosen the string on the mala, it looks like a solid thing, but as you loosen the string, you can see there's spaces between the beads. And he said, as the meditation, as the samadhi gets deeper, the mind relaxes to the point where instead of there being a sense of seamless self, you know, like in the old days when they had movies, 24 frames a second, then something would go wrong with the projector, and all of a sudden it would kind of start to slow on, oh, it's just a bunch of stills. Well, then you start to experience the self that way, you know? Like when you're getting bad digital reception and everything kind of gets, the pixels get all messed up, you know? Well, that's no fun. You know, the illusion is dispelled. It's exactly the same thing. Dispel the illusion of self, and then other things become possible. Next week, or next time we get together, I'll be talking about the constituents of self, the ingredients that go into making self. And that's a set of, it's a concept that the Buddha talked about called the skandhas, or the five aggregates. So if you want to do a little research online between now and then, you find out something about the skandhas, we'll talk about those. So that's the talk about the ingredients, the constituent elements. Okay, five aggregates affected by clinging. And then after that, we'll talk about the assembly process, how these five ingredients, how the mind puts them together to create self. And that's going to compel us to touch on a whole other set of teachings, collectively known as the doctrine of, or the teaching of dependent origination. So that's kind of where we're going with this whole thing. In the event you want to read ahead, meanwhile, I would like to devote the rest of our time this evening to having a discussion about everything I've just said, everything I've just put out there. It's kind of a lot, and it really goes against the grain in terms of how the mind likes to think, and also most other traditions out there in terms of how they put the world together. So please, I'd like to reflect together.
I had an extended conversation with a lady who's practicing Tibetan Buddhism, and it really sounds very much like she's back into that full reincarnation, which makes me wonder, is that part of the Tibetan tradition, or is that a small set within Tibetan, or do you know?
I'm not as well qualified to answer that question as somebody who has done a great deal of Tibetan practice. I know there's some people here in the Sangha who have. My limited experience in looking at the history of how Buddha Dharma came to Tibet, there are actually several different efforts from the time of the Buddha for his teachings to get established in Tibet. And the one that finally landed came up through Bengal. It was Tantric Yoga that became admixed with the Buddha's teachings and became Tantric Buddhism. And it's just a lot of different traditions that were already extant at the time. One of them is, you know, in the Theravada you'll hear the term rebirth used. In the Tibetan tradition you'll hear the use reincarnation used. Because it has more in common with Brahmanism than Theravada Buddhism does. And it's one of the distinctions between the Mahayana tradition and the Theravada tradition. As part of the system of instilling faith in your teacher, a lot more reliance on taking refuge with a particular teacher in many of the Tibetan traditions, and taking the teacher on as your guru, and having the teacher accept you as his or her guru. And part of that belief system for some schools of Tibetan, some of their schools, is a belief that the guru is in fact a reincarnation of a previous lama or monk or great spiritual teacher, and that he has been imbued with the wisdom and the knowledge of that teacher, and that's being passed down through the ages. Is that in the right neighborhood, Luke, as far as I know that you have a lot of experience with Tibetan practice? How would you answer Ken's question on that?
Well, you could, that covers a really big area.
Yeah, of course, yes.
Yeah. But you relate to the teacher, I mean, the guru on three different levels.
Yes.
One, you know, is the physical teacher, and then, you know, also there's the inner guru, your
yes.
own experience.
Yes.
And, you know, and then the historical Buddhas. So, you know, the purpose of guru yoga is to develop that that inner experience yourself.
Yes, of course. Thank you. Well put.
And then the last thing I would say is, you know, is working with a teacher closely gives you a really good reflection, because on the small mind level, we create our own suffering, and you know, it's easy to get caught up in that world, you know,
yep.
rather than working out of it.
Yeah. Words are indeed slippery things in this regard. But it is a little closer to the Brahman model. You know, Mahayana Buddhism generally, but Tibetan Buddhism in particular has a little more in common with that. Yeah, thank you. Others with Tibetan experience, you might want to say something?
Well,
very well, please.
I was wondering if the mysticism part, what the rites and the rituals are, seems a lot more.
Yes.
Present.
Yes.
But the mysticism part of the Buddhism.
Again, in my experience of the Theravada relative to the Mahayana, especially the Vajrayana, there is a great deal more ritual, actually, you know. But it's all sort of skillful means, you know, it's intended for a purpose, you know. And a lot of visualization work in the Tibetan practice. And it's sometimes thought that there is not mysticism in the Theravada, but I think that's not a correct apprehension, actually, at all. And it's one that even within Theravada realms has caused a lot of discourse and dialogue and whatnot. A lot of it comes down to what practices you're doing. There is one school of Theravada Buddhism that basically just says, you do insight meditation practice, and that's what has been called the direct path to realization. You just do that and nothing else, and that will take you where you need to go. There are other monasteries, other schools, other approaches that use, that bring in a variety of the different practices that the Buddha taught. And this is more the realm that my own experience lies in. So you have insight meditation, you have anapanasati, which is mindfulness of the breathing, certainly the practice of metta, loving kindness meditation, and the practice of the jhanas, or the meditative absorptions. What the meditative absorptions do, when the hindrances are already somewhat weak, whatnot, it's a form of deep samadhi practice that has the function of suppressing the hindrances altogether. And then when that happens, alternative states of consciousness can arise. There tends to be, sometimes it can manifest itself physically, okay, kind of a tingling or energetic effect. It manifests itself sometimes as the spontaneous release of a great deal of joy, of real deep calmness, right? And then some of those other aspects that I was talking about earlier, like a sense of transcendence and unity, can definitely occur. It's part of the jhanic experience. And so that definitely occurs within the Theravada as well. And just practicing insight meditation at a very deep level, when the mind gets calm enough and still enough, it can cease manufacturing self altogether. And when that experience happens, it's called the experience of anatta. In Zen, I believe it's called Satori. And when that occurs, there is a mystic quality to it because it's altogether extra-rational, you know, and it's simply bare experience. And one becomes aware of there being no one home. And that's very relieving. Very. So the mystic, I don't know if that's the, it's an interesting word. Mystery, mysterium is from the Latin, and meaning silence. Yeah. Just very deep silence. Yeah. Please. Oh, yes.
Going back to question one, whether we call it rebirth or whether we call it reincarnation, they seem to be similar concepts, which to my mind runs right up against anatta. Where are we here?
Reincarnation posits, you know, in the Brahman sense, posits the reconstruction of self in another body. That yourself hangs around, and it's going to keep hanging around until you achieve perfection in union with Brahman. In Theravada Buddhism, the self is a fiction. It's a construct. Gil Fronsdale sometimes describes insight meditation practice, or Buddhist meditation practice generally, as premature aging. And by that he means, essentially, the discursive mind is aging faster than the rest of the system. So that from time to time, the more deeply and consistently you practice, the more frequently you begin on occasion to get glimpses over experienced death of self. So the self starts dying off before the rest of the system does. And the first few times that is experienced, it's often kind of frightening or disturbing. And then after a while, as it becomes more familiar terrain, and the mind becomes, you know, more accustomed to deep samadhi meditation, then it becomes a state that the mind almost seems to seek out. And then you basically just, if this turns out to be the nature of your experience when you sit, and it's not for everybody, but if that does turn out to be what occurs, then essentially you're sort of experiencing on that, and you're taking in on the experiential realm that which the Buddha spoke about. And so insight into not self, insight to the self as fiction, means that if you're making it up as you go along, as soon as you stop making it up, it's not there anymore. We talk about experiencing the deathless, and that's what he's talking about. To experience the deathless is to experience the non-existence of self. So there's nothing to reincarnate. Does, of course, raise the question of what happens when you die, and we will go to that too, just not tonight. Probably take a whole session on that.
I have a question on that. I'm still a little confused. I don't think anybody else on that exact same question. Listening to Joseph Goldstein's talks from the Foundations of Mindfulness, and he, one of the talks on that, when there's a teacher that apparently was rebirth, and at the young age of like 2 or 3 was chanting very complex chants, and even remembered the monastery where he was. So what's that?
One of the most truthful people I've ever met in my life was a Burmese nun named Sister Dipankara, from whom I learned some jhana practice. And the way she came to become a novice at the Pak Monastery in southern Burma was she came there and had already been kind of doing some meditating on her own, and asked the abbot if she could practice there, and they were not real keen on having women around. And so he asked what it was that made her want to do so. And she said, well, every once in a while when I'm in a state of meditation, it seems as if there is a different state of consciousness there. And he said, well, can you give me an example? And she got into deep samadhi, and she started chanting verbatim a little known, about 500-year-old text that has only ever been shared among senior monks. She never had any way of having any access to it all. And she recited start to finish verbatim. And he said, oh, okay, why don't you join us? And there are a lot of examples of that. One way to understand that is if you think about fabric, like the fabric of our clothing, you know, it's these myriad threads that are woven together. Okay. You can think about each intersection of thread in the cloth as a point in time. So you can have a thread that's running lengthways down your arm that has these cross pieces. These cross pieces can be different points in time, but the thread is the bioenergetic continuity. So what happens when you email, so let's say you think about a friend who you have some kind thoughts about, you run across a poem that you think they might like, and so you write it to them in an email, right? Does the poem go through the fiber optic cables? What goes through the fiber optic cables? Ones and O's, right? Pulses of energy. So one way to understand this, the way the Buddha explained this, is it, when a candle is about to burn out, you take the candle and you light another candle with it. Okay. So he said the flame that was on that candle is not the same as the flame that's in this candle because it's based upon different fuel. Okay. But it's also not different because it was the transfer of that flame to the new candle that allowed it to ignite. Okay. So essentially what is happening is this transfer of energy. Okay. So that's what's happening right now. You know, I have an intention to explain a concept to you. I put it into words and then you hear it and you take it in and do with it what you will. So one way to understand this is that this is nothing more than this transfer of energy across space and time. Okay. One way of understanding it in Brahmanism and in some schools of Buddhism is that what comes through is sort of the entirety of that person's consciousness from their previous lifetime, in some sense of identity. This is who I was. Okay. Another way to understand it, however, is that all you're doing is experiencing the memories of someone who once existed. And for whatever reason, by means that we don't fully understand, and this, for people that get into deep samadhi practice, this is something that can arise. And in some, certainly in Brahmanism, in some schools of Buddhism, some will say, yes, that's who I was in this lifetime. And for others, it's more like a fragment of memory, okay, that for whatever reason we have become privy to, whether because of geographic location, whether because of state of mind, you know, in Sister Dipankara's case, there is one way of thinking about this is in fact that when you get into deep states of samadhi, the space-time continuum doesn't quite work in the same way. It is possible to simply intersect things that may have happened at a different point in time, a different place, a different consciousness. This is the kind of thing that the Buddha spoke of as metaphysical speculation. And he said, I've reflected on whether metaphysical speculation bears any important relationship whatsoever to the cessation of suffering. Mm-hmm. And I found that it is not. So whether the self is reincarnated, what happens when you die, all this is very interesting stuff, but what's it got to do with the cessation of suffering?
Yeah. Well, could it be then, like a simple way to look at that, is if we're nothing and we're just particles, and those particles disperse when you die, the difference would be whether or not they come in a package or just shoot out into the universe and people pick up different pieces.
Yeah.
Nice.
Please.
As you're wrapping up your talk, there's one thing that all of us are wondering. What happened with the movie theater?
Very good. The question was, you know, in the lawsuit between the racetrack and the movie theater, who won? As is often the case in the common law tradition, it basically came down to which business was the more profitable. The racetrack was bringing in more tax revenue, so there you go. So that's why we don't see any more movie theaters around, right? Okay. Let's take just a moment and get back into our sitting posture if we can. We become what we think. All that we are arises with our thoughts. With our thoughts, we create the world. Speak or act with unwholesome intention, and suffering shall follow you as surely as the wheels on the cart follow the oxen who draw it. We become what we think. All that we are arises with our thoughts. With our thoughts, we create the world. Speak or act with beneficial intention, and happiness will follow you as your shadow, unswerving. Have a good week. Be well.